This is Fresh Air. One of the themes of President Bush's campaign is the gridlocked Democratic Congress. The president says his programs have been blocked by Congress, and that's part of why our economy is in trouble. House Speaker Tom Foley says the president created the gridlock by vetoing the bills. Is our government deadlocked, and who's to blame? Steve Roberts has been covering American politics for over 25 years, so we asked him to explain what's going on. Roberts is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report and formerly wrote for the New York Times. He's a regular on the PBS program Washington Week in Review. I asked Roberts what the president means when he says we have a gridlocked Congress.
Well, I think the president means that he is very frustrated. We have a situation, really, Terry, where we have a coalition government in this country. The voters have chosen, in their wisdom over the last five elections, really, to not give either party a mandate, or either the Democratic Congress or the Republican White House, a clear mandate to govern this country. What they each have is the power to veto the other side's agenda. They do not have the power to enact their own agenda. And even though the president is very frustrated, I can tell you that there is an equal, if not larger, measure of frustration on Capitol Hill as well. We really have government by veto.
So the government is gridlocked?
I think the government is gridlocked most of the time, not always. This system can work, and it has worked, in two ways. It works, for instance, when both sides decide, and this is relatively rare, particularly in a political year, when both sides decide that it's more important to move on a piece of legislation than to play politics with it, substance over form. We saw this with the Clean Air Act, very, very complicated piece of legislation, many economic interests involved. Both sides were very tempted to play politics. Democrats were tempted to send a bill to George Bush that would be too strong, force him to veto it so they could go to the country and say, see, really not the environmental president. Instead, they did an interesting thing. They pulled back their stronger bill, negotiated with the White House, faced a very clear decision that they would prefer to have a bill than not have one, than have an issue. And it worked. The bill became law. George Bush signed it. It also works when there is an upswelling of pressure from around the country, Terry, that forces both parties to work together, perhaps even when they don't want to. Best example in recent months of that was extending unemployment benefits. George Bush rejected two attempts by Congress to extend unemployment benefits. By the time the third one came around, the economy was nosediving. His popularity was following the nosedive of the economy downward. And he was as eager as anything to finally sign it. So he didn't want to. He rejected two of them, but he was forced to by public pressure from outside of Washington. In those kinds of cases, the system works. But those are the exceptions rather than the rule.
Well, the president is blaming the troubled economy on the gridlocked Congress. In his State of the Union address, President Bush gave Congress a deadline to pass his economic bill, but then he vetoed the bill that Congress passed. Is that an example of the kind of politics that you're talking about?
Exactly. Interestingly enough, on that bill, Terry, both sides thought that they were winning politically from the same bill. Obviously, they're both not right. The Democrats specifically sent Bush a bill, even though it met his deadline as he has set it up in the State of the Union, and it contained a number of the proposals that George Bush wanted. When he gets up and says, my program hasn't been tried and the Democrats have stopped everything I wanted, that's a little disingenuous. The fact is that the bill that the Congress passed contained a lot of what George Bush wanted. But it also contained something he very much did not want and could not accept, which was a tax increase, particularly on wealthy taxpayers. He had been so burned by the Read My Lips pledge that he just could not sign any bill that contained a tax increase. Now, of course, the Democrats specifically put the tax increase in there, in part because they thought Bush would veto it. So both sides were playing politics. The Democrats calculated that if they raised taxes on the wealthy and cut them on the middle class, they could then take this bill and George Bush's veto and go to the country and say, see, he really just cares about the wealthy. He didn't want taxes raised on his rich friends, and he doesn't care about you average middle class voters who would have gotten a tax break out of this. The Republicans, when Bush vetoed the bill, also made a very political calculation. They say, if we veto this bill, we can go to the country and say, dear voter, they're at it again. They're taxing you. They're going to take your tax money and spend it. They might say it's only on the rich, but really don't believe them, because once they say taxes, the door is open. And in fact, taxes have been the magic bullet for Republicans for years. The Democrats are incapable of mentioning the word taxes without paying a political price. The Republicans were counting on that.
Is basically what you're saying, everybody's more worried about re-election than they are about actually doing something for the economy?
Well, I think that, yes, that in some ways is what I'm saying. If both sides of this coalition government, the Democratic Congress and the Republican White House, decide on any given issue that they want to play politics, then the system grinds completely to a halt. The only way this can work, given the fact that the voters have consistently voted for divided government. This is not, this is not an accident, and it's not something new. They have consistently voted for a Democratic Congress, which says, I'm not going to reduce domestic spending, and a president who says, I'm not going to increase your taxes. It sounds like, in fact, I'm going to cut your taxes. In effect, they voted for a free lunch, and there's no such thing. So the voters have to bear a significant part of the responsibility for this deadlock, even though they complain about it. As long as political considerations are paramount, it's going to remain that way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Roberts. He's a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, and he's covered politics and Congress for about 28 years. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the, quote, gridlocked Congress and the deadlock in our government with Steve Roberts of U.S. News and World Report. How gifted is the president at persuading Congress to vote on bills that the president wants to pass?
He is actually not a very good persuader at all, Terry. And one of the reasons why you do have this increased gridlock on Capitol Hill is that George Bush doesn't have anything like the ability his predecessor Ronald Reagan had to go to the American people, to stir up sentiment and force Congress, to intimidate Congress, to frighten Congress into doing what he wants done. I was covering Capitol Hill for the New York Times in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan was sweeping his program through Congress, even though there was a Democratic majority in the House. One of the reasons he did it was because, as Tip O'Neill, then the Speaker of the House, said to me, he said, we cannot stand up to this guy. He goes on television and stirs people up, and our offices are bombarded with calls and letters, and we have to go along with him. George Bush frightens nobody. George Bush is lousy on television. He has no sense of drama, no sense of emotion. So no one on Capitol Hill lives with any fear that if they cross the president, he can exact a punishment. And politics is a process of punishments and rewards. And he has very little to offer in the way of rewards and almost nothing to threaten in the way of punishment. So he isn't very good at it. And in fact, the one person on his staff who is good at it is Richard Darman, the budget director, who was the chief architect of the budget package back 18 months, 2 years ago, which included, of course, the famous tax increase, which resulted in Bush breaking his no new taxes pledge. That package, in the eyes of many people on Capitol Hill, was the most statesmanlike, the most courageous thing that Bush has done in his entire presidency. But because it got attacked by the right wing, he totally capitulated. He now says it was a mistake, and basically has abandoned any claim that he was doing the right thing. And that only adds to the deadlock, Terry, because it adds to the feeling that for those people who try to be responsible and try to make compromises and try to take risks, they're going to have their feet pulled out from under them. And that's what the president did on his own compromise.
You're saying that the Congress isn't afraid of the president getting on TV and criticizing the Congress before
Not at
Americans.
All, Terry.
But are people in Congress now worried about the strategy that the president is using, blaming Congress for the troubled economy?
Well, I think there are ripples of concern that they're never happy when they're attacked. There is some concern about it, but in fact, ironically, some of the most visible victims of the anti-incumbent, anti-Congress mood that the Republicans themselves have helped stoke up have been Republicans. We saw it just this week in Oklahoma, where the number three or four man in the House Republican leadership, Mickey Edwards, was defeated in a Republican primary. Another leading Republican in the House, Guy Vanderjack of Michigan, was also defeated in a primary. Newt Gingrich barely survived. Vin Weber, another member of the Republican leadership, rather than run for re-election in a difficult race, decided to quit. So three of the major Republicans in the House have been fatally wounded by the grenades thrown by their fellow Republicans, and they ain't happy about it, I can tell you. One of the Republicans said, I don't know why Gingrich and the other bomb throwers or grenade throwers, I don't know why they thought if they threw a grenade in the middle of Congress that they could control where the explosion went. Mm-hmm. And they obviously have not been able to do that. I'm sure there are some nervous Democrats, but historically, Terry, the ability of a president to run against Congress has not been very great. People remember Harry Truman, but that was a long time ago when people were much more party-oriented, far less willing to think for themselves. Ronald Reagan went all over this country at the height of his popularity in 1986, urging people to vote for a Republican Congress, saying, vote for the Gipper one last time. The voters turned around and voted the Republicans out of the majority in the Senate and voted the Democrats back in, despite Ronald Reagan's best efforts. So when you see things like that, I don't think people are all that nervous.
My guest is Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Roberts says voters share some of the responsibility for the deadlock government, and that's one of the things we'll talk about after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Steve Roberts is my guest. What are some of the political and economic, social issues that you think might be getting stalled now because of the gridlock in government?
Well, it's a good question. I would divide that into sort of three areas. The first, of course, is economics, and particularly the ability to deal with the deficit. Ronald Reagan came in 12 years ago and said to people, I'm going to cut your taxes, I'm going to raise defense spending, and I'm not going to reduce social services. That was a proposal that George Bush called voodoo economics. He was right then, and he's right now. Those numbers never added up, but people didn't want to confront the fact that they never added up, and so we have a $4 trillion deficit. The only way you're going to deal with the deficit is basically to increase taxes, cut spending, or both. But people don't want to do that. If you were watching in the last day or two, for instance, stories from Florida and Louisiana, people battered by the storm, and very, very genuine suffering. I was noticing last night some people saying, where is the government? Why aren't they bailing us out? Where are they? Where's the cavalry? I bet an awful lot of those people who were saying that today, Terry, were delighted when Ronald Reagan said to them, the government's the problem, not the solution. We waste all our tax money on undeserving welfare queens, and we're going to cut your taxes to you God-fearing middle-class Americans. The fact is that people want these services. They don't want to pay for them. And with the current gridlock, it is so easy to play demagogue on this question. George Bush did it again at his own convention. He comes up and says, I'm going to cut your taxes. But he doesn't say how he's going to pay for it. And he refuses to say how he's going to pay for it until the election. Well, that just panders to the worst instincts of voters who want to believe that they can get these services for free. And so given the current gridlock and given the current penchant for playing politics, as Bush demonstrated, it's almost impossible to get well-meaning people from both sides of the aisle to get together and say, look, we're going to tell people the truth. That's the only way it's going to happen. But it's not only a failure of leadership, it's a failure of followership. Leaders are reluctant to do it because when they do it, voters turn against them. So economics is the first question, but there are many other issues that are stalled as a result of this as well. There's a whole series of bills, for instance, that relate to the family and the new nature of American families and with so many more women in the workplace. A very good example is legislation that would mandate companies of a certain size to require them to provide unpaid leave for parents of new children or people who have aging parents who need medical care. This would make an enormous difference in the lives of a lot of stressed out American middle class families. But again, it's a political question. The Democrats are pushing a stringent bill in the hopes that Bush will veto it. Bush is against it because his friends in the big business community don't want this kind of government mandate, and so there's a deadlock. I think that efforts to reform education are another example where been stalled at over political wrangling. And there's a very long list beyond that, but those are just three examples.
Do you have any hopes that this political deadlock will be ended in the near future?
No, I don't. I think that what is probably the most likely outcome even now is that the Democrats retain strong control of the Congress and that George Bush is reelected. Now, if Bill Clinton is elected in the fall, and this week, for the first time, I believed it was really possible when I noticed that the post-convention bounce that Bush had gotten had really receded rather quickly. It's now a glimmer of possibility that Clinton actually will be elected. If that were to happen, then I think you might have a relatively brief period in the first year of the Clinton administration where Democrats controlled both the Congress and the White House, where you might see some things unstuck. But the rules of Congress are such that the Republicans almost certainly would have enough strength in the Senate to filibuster a number of pieces of legislation if they choose to take that route. So the system still would have a lot of roadblocks in it. And secondly, as I said earlier, the voters are part of this equation. Bill Clinton and Democratic Congress would have to really take some very painful measures to deal with the underlying economic problems. And it's a very open question whether they're going to have the guts to get up and tell people the truth and try to convince them of that the short-term pain is worth a long-term gain. And if they don't have that kind of courage and that kind of leadership skill, then in many ways the fact that one party controls both branches of government is not going to make all that much difference.
Since you think voters are an important part of the equation of what's wrong right now politically, what advice would you have to voters? I'm not talking about who to vote for, but about how to think about the electoral process.
Well, you know, voters are congenitally unhappy with politicians. They complain that they don't talk about the issues. They complain that they're being manipulated by negative commercials, all of which is true. But there is no real mechanism in a way because for voters to express this except at the polls. But I think that what's necessary as part of this process of ending the paralysis is for voters individually and as groups, as they organize themselves in the special interest groups or whatever, to say to the political leadership that we will support truth-telling. We will support courage. We will accept the bad news. The one person who really tried to do that during the primary campaign, of course, was Paul Tsongas. He was successful for a while. But it was Bill Clinton, more than anybody, who proved how risky it is to be a truth teller in politics, because he, during the Florida primaries and the Super Tuesday, he took some of Paul Tsongas' proposals, very modest proposals actually, for gasoline tax increases, for certain small limits on the cost of living increases of entitlement programs, and he just rammed them down Paul Tsongas' throat. He ran against him and crushed him. So the voters at that point had the choice of voting for somebody who was telling them the truth, and they allowed someone who demagogued the issue to win the day. So I just think that the guts is needed on both sides, courage is needed on both sides, a sense of civic responsibility is needed on both sides, a sense that you can't keep spending money you don't have, and I can't keep running into debt. And voters keep saying, you know, well, those damn congressmen, they can't balance their own checkbooks. And they get very self-righteous about it. But the fact is, they do keep voting for people who won't tell them the truth.
Well, Steve Roberts, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Steve Roberts is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report and a regular on the PBS program Washington Week in Review.